Welcome to What is Going Om, for new thought from the edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello and welcome. The announcement of a recent breakthrough drug that can slow down the progress of Alzheimer's is really encouraging, but we're still a long way off finding a cure. And in the meantime, those who are living with cognitive changes and their caregivers are left struggling to deal with the emotional and psychological impact of a disease that is notorious for robbing people of their personhood, their self-identity, and their dignity. Stephen G. Post, PhD, is the director of the Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care, and Bioethics at the Renaissance School of Medicine at Stony Brook University. He's also a founding member of the Alzheimer's Association's National Ethics Committee and the author of The Moral Challenge of Alzheimer's Disease, Ethical Issues from Diagnosis to Dying, and the newly released Dignity for Deeply Forgetful People, How Caregivers Can Meet the Challenges of Alzheimer's Disease, which shifts the focus from finding a cure for Alzheimer's to seeing and connecting with the whole person, their core personality, preferences, emotions, creativity, and capacity for joy, despite the limitations of dementia. Stephen G. Post, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. It's very nice to see you. I'm so happy to be with you.
What a book, Stephen, and what a badly needed book. You've devoted 30 years to working with caregivers and individuals with dementia. I want to know, when did your interest in this area first begin?
My grandmother was from Sheffield, England. She developed dementia in the last decade of her life. I would visit her quite frequently because we had a close relationship. That was a time, happily, before feeding pegs were used much. We did assisted oral feeding. And even when she had faded and was not able to communicate verbally, although I had to be open to surprises because sometimes she would be there and sometimes she wouldn't be there. It was somewhat sporadic. But I would do assisted oral feeding with Grandma Post. And that means applesauce and bran and such things. But it was almost ritualistic. And at times she would just brighten up and you could see emotion and joy in her eyes. And I felt her presence. I felt that she came back into herself in that kind of back and forth. And so at that point in my life, I was in my mid-20s, I recognized that when people are deeply forgetful, we have no business saying that they're gone, that they're a husk, that they're a shell. We have to recognize and notice, to use a term that Larry Dossey likes a lot, we have to notice the hints at continuing self-identity. And we even have to instigate those in various ways and so that there can be real communication. And I've spent most of my career in medical schools, but focusing on deeply forgetful individuals and how we can connect with them and include them and not view them as demented and therefore totally different than us. Because we all have our moments.
Indeed, we all do. We all do. This deeply forgetful is a beautiful description. And I know this is a term that you came up with because you really don't like the word dementia. I don't think any of us like those words because they have the most awful connotations attached to them. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the structure of the word dementia, it's a little bit like the word retard. Yeah. We don't refer to people as retards or retarded. We talk about them as differently abled. We talk about them as perhaps having special needs, but we don't talk about them in a purely negative sense anymore. And dementia is a purely negative term. It means a decline from a former mental state. And it invites derision. So sometimes you hear politicians, insensitive politicians, referring to their adversaries as, oh, she's demented or he's demented. That bothers me. Mm-hmm. Well, so in the clinical setting, I was doing a grand rounds at Sloan Kettering yesterday, just 3 hours on people who are deeply forgetful and how to manage them at the end of life. But in the clinical setting, the word dementia invites these negative metaphors, gone, absent, husk, dead, and so forth. And I find that that really obstructs us from taking the time and the interest in communicating, in noticing, in responding to the self that is still there underneath the decline, the neurological decline.
Mm. Well, your book, the new one, Dignity, I mean, it has been praised as the best summary of medical ethical issues in Alzheimer's disease from diagnosis to the end stage yet produced by anyone. Now, you'd previously written The Moral Challenge of Alzheimer's Disease. What is different about this book?
Well, you know, The Moral Challenge, I was very happy when that came out. And your British Medical Journal voted that that was one of the medical classics of the 20th century, which completely shocked me and was probably a mistake. But anyway, it was really just on the clinical ethical type issues. I did coin some language there. I didn't use the word deeply forgetful. And it wasn't spiritually oriented. I have a chapter in this new book, Is Grandma Still There? You know, so it's very metaphysical now, my work. But back then, you know, it was, do you want to use a feeding peg on a person who's 92? What about advanced directives? What about this and that, the other thing? And it was meaningful. It was a successful piece of work. But I always felt that something more had to be said about the continuing self-identity and the nature of mind. So now, you know, I'm very much, you know, mind before matter. And therefore, when an individual is deeply forgetful, it doesn't mean that they're not there in some full sense. I actually coined the term paradoxical lucidity once upon a time. We get back to that. But you have to be open to these wonderful surprises. And suddenly someone who seemed gone is quite there. And that can be stimulated by personalized music, by Alzheimer's poets. You can bring them back into themselves for at least periods of time. And that continues right to the end of life. So I know a guy in New York who passed away of Alzheimer's not long ago. And to the very last day, he had his beads and he was chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. Nam-myoho. So his linear rationality, you know, means ends rationality was very limited, but his symbolic rationality, his sense of who he was in the light of those symbols and that idea of the one mind, I think that was still there. And who knows? Look, maybe he was freed up from some of the anxieties of our age. You know, we don't do nothing for nothing, as they say sometimes. Maybe he was liberated in a way and he got back in touch with his truer self.
Well, you know, paradoxical lucidity is an interesting thing because, you know, you write about it and, you know, lots and lots of caregivers apparently report that suddenly it's like a curtain lifts and there's the person. This also happens very frequently with people who at end of life, just before they're dying. You know, people say, oh, she was at death's door and then she came back and then she left, you know. Do you think it's the same kind of mechanism going on there?
Yeah, we're studying that very significantly. And I'd be happy to say that our National Institutes of Health here in the U.S. 4 years ago actually issued a request for scientific proposals to study paradoxical lucidity, because they thought maybe it could give us some insight into what's going on with the brain and maybe we can capitalize on it in some way. But is it the same as what you'd call terminal lucidity? I think it's certainly closely related, but terminal lucidity really has to do with those individuals who have, shall we say, come back, and they will talk about the bright light. They will talk about transformation. They will talk about morphic fields of love and so forth. And I find that all very compelling. In fact, we recently did an article with Sam Parnia, who's from Southampton, the UK, in the New York Academy of Science on remembered experiences of death. And so I do think that's very important and worth working on. But paradoxical lucidity doesn't have to do with really the end stage. Someone can be relatively mute, and then if properly stimulated, we have in Brooklyn Heights a memory center for older adults, and we use poetry. Alzheimer's poets, there are such people, you know, and they know how to read a poem that this particular age group would connect with, like The Road Less Traveled. And when they do it with spirit, with animation, kind of like Robert Bly might, you know, they come back into themselves, and a lot of them will begin to chime in with lines or verses. And then afterwards, maybe 70 or 80% of them for at least a few minutes are relatively lucid. We have something that started at NYU maybe 10 years ago called the Unforgettables. How do you like that? A choir begun by Mary Middleman, who was a wonderful sociologist. And these are caregivers and then people who are really severely, deeply forgetful. But when they sing together, I always say to caregivers, sing with your loved one. Don't just view it as obnoxious, you know, when they start humming away, but sing with them. And they do this, and they connect in such beautiful ways. And they even have a choral recital on Lexington Avenue and 50th Street at St. Peter's Lutheran Church every 6 months. And it's incredible what goes on there. And so music is still the language of the angels, if you will. And if you use deeply learned music, meaningful music, you can be absolutely astonished at the ways in which a person can come alive inside.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there've been a number of studies done on music specifically, but there are other things as well, creative pursuits, you know, dementia dogs, which I think is something that you've been a great advocate of.
Yeah. I'm a big advocate of dementia dogs. I used to be on the board of the Stirling Alzheimer's Association in Scotland, and they were very prolific and very impressive, and I was so honored to have anything to do with them. But they actually, at that point, came up with the idea of the dementia dog, and I have been a proponent of that for, I'm sorry to say, probably 25 years. Look, a dog doesn't give a hoot if your memory is not too good. This is why C.S. Lewis put dogs in heaven, because they're completely unconditional, and you come home and they're happy. So now in Scotland, they have Alzheimer's dogs that are very carefully trained. They're usually mid-sized Labradors, and people can be assigned an Alzheimer's dog. And they get so much joy out of this. In the book, I describe many such cases. People just come alive, and they, you know, they remember their younger years when they had their favorite dog, Sparky. It all comes back to them. It's about tender, loving care. And we actually in Sydney, Australia, had a conference. This was about 9 years ago. We had about 50 to 80 people with their Alzheimer's dogs. These were significantly deeply forgetful individuals, not at the severe stage, but quite significantly struggling. And they had their dogs. And we marched out from this hotel down the main drag in Sydney, past the old Hospital of New South Wales. And the dogs were wearing vests, you know, which had forget-me-not flowers on them. And there was a cabbie who drove up. And he said to me, "Blimey, dogs are for blind people. And that's the attitude sometimes. But actually, they are incredibly significant for someone who's deeply forgetful. It's very beautiful.
It seems like a silly question, but is there not a risk that somebody could forget to feed their dog and take care of the things they need to take care of?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's you want to have a dementia dog, and you also want to have ideally a caregiver around who can manage these things, because we cannot expect someone who is terribly deeply forgetful to take care of an animal. But when it works out, it works beautifully. It just gives them new life. It's like the intergenerational schools, which we founded in Cleveland with Peter Whitehouse, the famous neurologist, and his wife, Kathy. And they're now all over the U.S. So you have, say, first and second grade schools. They're usually charter schools. And then the folks with deep forgetfulness will come in from assisted living and from nursing homes, or just from the community. And, you know, the kids love it. And our studies show that the deeply forgetful people get stimulated by the kids, you know, hey, the little kids. And lo and behold, they'll start reading from children's books and color and doing coloring books with the kids in a way that you would not anticipate. So that intergenerational piece is a very beautiful thing. And it's incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dignity draws on your, 30 years or more of case experience to answer many, many of the larger questions. What are the really large questions that we need to be addressing around Alzheimer's and the care of the deeply forgetful?
Well, one of those questions is exceedingly controversial. I have a chapter on 16 questions from diagnostic unveiling, do you want to use the A word? Do you want to speak about dementia early on or wait for a few visits? And how do you want to handle that? All the way to placement in nursing homes, to assisted oral feeding, to the whole question of whether you want to continue with treatment for things like diabetes. Because, you know, if you're deeply forgetful, a shot is not something that you have insight into. And therefore, it can be subjectively interpreted as somewhere on the range between assault and torture. Dialysis. I was a dialysis technician when I got out of college. I was putting people on dialysis machines with butterfly needles in their bovine grafts. And it was okay when they were insightful, but when they were deeply forgetful, even then I was sensitive to this. This was really very difficult, and even sometimes close to torture. So there's a sense in which when someone becomes so deeply forgetful that they lack these insights, you have to ask yourself, do we want to continue with dialysis, with insulin, with treatments for chronic heart problems? Those are all big issues that we were discussing yesterday, actually, with the folks at Sloan Kettering. So there are many things. The most controversial issue, which has to be addressed now, and I didn't address it much earlier on, is what I'll call preemptive assisted suicide.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, I live in New York, and in New York, we don't allow assisted suicide. It's not part of our structure. But in New Jersey, it's been passed into law. And it's even possible, and there are lots of cases of individuals who have been quote unquote euthanized. So the people in Manhattan are nervous, because if someone just goes over to the other side of the Hudson River, it's a different universe. And my problem, you know, I actually, when I was at Case Western, I knew Kevorkian a little bit. He actually applied to our Center for Bioethics for a job. His first subject was a woman named Janet Atkins. And now we're talking about 1988, 89. She was a school teacher from Portland, Oregon. She had a pretty stable diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. It was progressing, but not too quickly. And she could no longer, she was a civics teacher, read articles in the newspapers that she managed in her classes. And she also couldn't remember her favorite Chopin sonatas. She was a good pianist. And she'd gone up to Seattle to get on a research protocol for one of the new drugs, which did nothing for her at all. So she got together with her husband and her three sons, and they were all part of the Hemlock Society. And they escorted her to Flint, Michigan. She went behind that Walmart's and got in a gray van, and there was Dr. Kevorkian. And he had his Mercitron, language being so important, his Mercitron there in the van, and put that needle in her arm. And it was assisted suicide because she was still able to push the final red button that allowed the poison to flow into her veins. Now, that's very, very controversial, but I have to tell you, I received an email from one of my closest friends, who's probably 90 now, in Ohio, in Cleveland. And it was very difficult. This is just this summer. She loved her sister very, very much and wanted to be a good caregiver. But her sister, with her closest, her husband and children, wanted to go off to Switzerland to Dignitas. And my friend was so upset about this. She couldn't believe it. I mean, have I failed my sister? And I tried to explain to her that, you know, you can't control this, and it's something she wants to do, and you can try to convince her otherwise. But the sister actually went to Dignitas and was not heard of again. So I don't, I'm not a proponent of this. Don't misunderstand me. I don't advocate for it, but I've never been able to condemn somebody or want to judge them. You know, they say, judge not lest ye be judged. I don't want to judge somebody because the Dutch have a word, ontluistering, which means self-effacement, that sort of peeling away of capacity. And even the ancient Stoics, they didn't advocate for suicide, except for very older adults who kind of knew they were on a strong downward course.
Yeah.
So it's very sensitive all over the globe right now.
It is a very sensitive issue. My sister had cancer and I was staying with her and I was her caregiver. And she was going to do that in Canada because it was legal. She was adamant that when the time came, as it happened, she didn't do that. She died naturally. COVID, during COVID, not of COVID, but during COVID. And I could never, ever get my head around that decision.
Yes.
And dreaded the thought that I would have to be with her, when she did that.
Well, that's a very, very deep statement. That has so many powerful layers. Yeah, so people can go to Montreal and Quebec, and it's not just preemptive assisted suicide. They can actually have euthanasia. They can actually be killed, their prior request. Yeah. And the problem with this, of course, my writing is against this in general. I'm all for relationship, learning how to communicate, using language well, noticing all the signs and symbols and actions that can have purpose. When a guy in Cleveland would come into the Foley Elder Healthcare Center in the mornings to do art therapy, he would scribble these chaotic lines on a pad of paper, and we'd ask him, "What's that, Joe?" And he could never respond. But then one morning, incidentally, there was always two lines down the middle of his otherwise chaotic sketching. I asked him, "What is that?" And he said, "It's a map so my daughter can find her way to my house." And that was all we hear of him. So there was still purpose. There was purpose behind what he was doing. And that's where this idea of one mind and mind before matter, and that mind is not derived necessarily from brain and tissue and matter, but it could have a deeper reality, which I discuss at some length in my book. And I actually believe that. So in that sense, mind is never gone. And these hints are not just sporadic firings of little bits of neurological tissue, but they're an unveiling of what really is still underneath it all. Think of the Akashic memory, for example, in Hinduism and Buddhism. So for me, I'm not an advocate, but I've run into so many individuals now, at least two or three dozen, who have gone the route of assisted suicide. I talk about one fellow in the book who was a street clown in San Francisco. And he performed magic on the library steps for generations. He was a favorite of the San Francisco population. But he lived alone. That's now called a live alone. I don't know what I think of that expression, but about 20% of people with dementia don't have families around them. And so he just didn't feel he would have an advocate. He'd wind up with a tube in every orifice, natural and unnatural. And so he went off to Dignitas, and that was the last we heard of him. And I wrote an article, acknowledging his decision, not necessarily approving it, but recognizing that it was, in his eyes, valid.
Yes, yeah. I mean, none of us can know, what is going on in someone's mind in that situation, and none of us can judge it. You know, if they feel that's the best thing for them, it is the best thing for them. I want to come back to the mind after the break. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with Stephen G. Post, who's recognized worldwide as the foremost medical humanist and ethicist writing on the vitally important topic of Alzheimer's disease. And we're talking about his latest book, Dignity for Deeply Forgetful People, How Caregivers Can Meet the Challenges of Alzheimer's Disease, which lifts the veil on that dreaded disease and provides insights, explanations, and hope for retaining the connections that count. We'll be back with more from Stephen G. Post after the break.
Om Times TV. Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust, spheric approach. Om Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, Om Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an Om Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on Om Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive Om Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. Om Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times' flagship radio show, What Is Going On? And as an author, editor, and 13 times book judge who's read thousands of books and interviewed hundreds of authors, I'm constantly asked, what's really worth reading and what's not? So I created the No BS Spiritual Book Club to help you save time and money by picking the brains of discerning names who've walked this path before you. There's no catch, no fees, and no BS, just an ever-growing library of 10 best spiritual book lists from some of your favourite authors and teachers, plus free book excerpts, audios, and video interviews with people like Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., David G., Lee Harris, Mark Nepo, and more. From well-known classics to hidden gems you've never heard of, it's the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to enlighten your journey of self-discovery. So why not join the club? Get inspired and save money at the No BS SpiritualBookClub.com.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's one in five daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Stephen G. Post, in the book Essential Writings on Creation Spirituality, Matthew Fox says, the understanding of mind in the classical scientific age is that of the computer. the understanding of mind in the emerging era is that of the human spirit and how it is rooted in the divine emptiness that is inseparably involved with the human spirit. Many quantum physicists, people like Amit Goswami, are talking now about the mind not being located in the brain, that the mind is outside of us, it's non-local, and that the memories live in the mind. So if we have a look at that, you know, where is the person when they are not cognitively present?
Thank you for asking that, which is the very deepest and most meaningful big question around this population, without any doubt. When I was a younger guy, I was at the University of Chicago, and I had the opportunity to study with Sir John Eccles, an Australian and British Nobel laureate, who had been awarded the prize for figuring out all the basics of communication between nerve cells, the synaptic interactions and so forth. He was a brilliant man, but he insisted that mind is not derived from matter. He dismissed very quickly the idea of mind is nothing but brain. He called that nothing buttery. And yet he was a great scientist. So his metaphysical view was that he was not simply a materialist. He believed in the primacy of mind in the universe. And a lot of philosophers of mind, as well as good scientists, take that perspective. And I do too. I take that entirely. So I was talking with an African-American mentor of mine whose sister had recently passed away with Alzheimer's in Detroit. And we were sharing ideas on the cell phone. And I said, Pastor, were you with her in those last days? And he said, yes. And I said, so did you think she was somehow gone? And he suggested to me that, no, I think she was ahead of me. I think she had probably already gone down to the Amtrak station somehow or another. He was speaking in an amusing way, and had her foot on that one train bound for glory. And you know, I love to see the ways in which people who are very deeply forgetful, surprisingly, will connect with spiritual symbols that they've identified with over the course of their lives. And so I have never underestimated the spiritual presence of a person who is deeply forgetful. And that's one of the reasons, Sandy, that I like the language of deep forgetfulness, because it's almost mystical in its intonations. And Larry Dossey wrote a great comment on this book. He was euphoric to see it, because I love Larry Dossey's book, One Mind. And it just says so much. I mean, he's such a great person, great person. And he loves this book because no one had ever quite addressed this population from that metaphysical perspective. So absolutely. And I have a chapter on memory. I could talk about that for a second, but you know, the computer. So we think that memory is somehow explained by our neurology. But let me tell you, you know, Tolkien, Eccles, Wilbur, the list is infinite. There are so many very good people, scientists and humanists, who don't think that that tissue alone can explain how we can tap into, in a millisecond, memories of a lifetime. Like Augustine wrote about in the Confessions, you can just bring back whole images of the sea and of your youthful experience when you first heard the Beatles, "I Want to Hold Your Hand." You can just bring that up in a second, and there's no adequate neurological explanation for that we have at all. I mean, most of what memory does is it looks at how you can ingrain certain behaviors, say, in rodents. Say they will become habituated to turn this way or that way, but it doesn't get into these deeper elements. And I'm convinced, actually, that the better model for memory, it's, you know, if you say that all the memory is in the brain, it's like saying all the memory is in your laptop computer, right? Or in your desktop computer. But actually, most of the memory is in the cloud, right? And that's what I mean by sort of the Akashic memory. And there's some great neuroscientists in Canada who have written beautiful articles about this in leading journals. They just don't think that brain tissue can explain memory. So the memory is there. And that's where the whole idea of karma is rooted, that somehow there is this recording of our actions and attitudes and so forth. That's not to say that we can't be entirely forgiven and understood and loved despite that, but there is a sense in which our memory is much deeper than matter. And that's the mind before matter approach. It's very Hindu. By the way, I have to tell you this story, which is in the book too. I went with Joe Foley, a very famed neurologist and my mentor at Case Western for 20 years, to a town in the middle of Ohio called Mount Vernon. And there's a geriatric psychiatric hospital there. And one wing of it is for people with Down syndrome, most of whom, by the time they're 50, will have dementia. And there were these wonderful Hindu caregivers there, a little community of Hindu nurses, aides, and one doctor. And they were in there and they were so kind and so generous and so meticulous. And you could pick it all up in the quality of their voice, in their facial expression. They loved these deeply forgetful people in a profound way that most of us would just not even think possible. So Joe and I took a couple of them out to a pizza restaurant and we asked them, so we are so impressed by your love for these individuals. What motivates you? And they said, as all your audience will know, they might have said, namaste. So I honor the divine in you as you honor the divine in me. And that becomes very, very important because caregivers, the really successful ones, frequently believe that there's, and we're doing a national study on this, frequently believe that there really is something more to mind than matter. And so spirit comes into it. I mean, we did a survey of American adults 8 years ago, coast to coast, a wonderful survey, and we wrote a book about it with Oxford. And it turns out that 80% of American adults have had experiences of profound synchronicity where they just felt that somehow the perfect thing had happened at the perfect time, and it was inexplicable by normal causality. Mm-hmm. So their conclusion is that we're more cherished in the universe than we know, and that there's a lot more spiritual activity than we can really properly understand. And I think that's exactly what's going on with these populations of people with dementia secondary to Parkinson's, to stroke, to Alzheimer's, to so many different disease conditions.
Well, you know, I have a lot of friends who have often jokingly, you know, said, given the world we're living in right now, who would want to stay present to it? Wouldn't you want, you know, to be somewhere else, somewhere that you could control, you know, and not have to deal with all of this?
So, you know, one of my favorite books is Austin's The Age of Anxiety. And, you know, right now, anxiety, depression are through the roof. And it's not getting any better, I'm afraid. So we really need to find inner peace.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we're yanked out of that inner center of our being, of our souls, which is what meditation and awe before nature is all about. We're yanked out of it by so many distractions and we're reacting to the things around us. So case in point, I actually think that Alzheimer's disease is a disease in part that's the direct result of the age of anxiety. And so there was a great artist, he was an abstract expressionist named Wilhelm de Kooning. And he hung out with Jackson Pollock and he painted a lot in New York City. He's in all the galleries and his stuff is just so anxious. He was the artist of anxiety. It's like that picture, The Scream. You could just feel it, you know, and we're all screaming at some level. And so now, you know, I went to a conference at Berkeley 15 years ago. There were no neurologists, Sandy, there who were willing to say that anxiety and stress contribute directly to dementia. Now, I cannot find anyone who doesn't believe that because they've laid down these circuitries and they realize that it's that protracted stress that doesn't just contribute to vascular disease or slower wound healing, but actually causes hippocampal atrophy. And the hippocampus is the part of the brain that lays down short-term memories. And when people have Alzheimer's, you know, they usually have some pretty deep memories of a long time ago, you know, those special moments. And their personality, if you can touch into that, is still quite compelling. But they can't remember, who they were just introduced to or why they're going to the supermarket that they, you know, and that's the problem, but it's the anxiety. And so de Kooning, he was diagnosed at Cornell. For 14 years, he had Alzheimer's disease. For 13 and a half years, Sandy, he lived in a loft in Greenwich Village with an assistant. And he would just sporadically rise up and he would put his brush in acrylic and then he would go up and he would paint. And his painting looked like Georgia O'Keeffe. It wasn't anxious anymore. Okay. It was spiritually uplifting. He wasn't one of these people who would say, I don't do nothing for nothing, you know, which is something I hear around at times. And he was freed. He was freed of anxiety, but also of the negative myths that, you know, everything is transactional. Everything is payback. He got away from that and his work changed. And the critics, he passed away. There was a posthumous exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art. Some of the critics said, oh, that he was a shell of his former self. This is a mockery of de Kooning. But one person who I liked, and I quote, said, wait a minute, this is a guy who had dementia for 14 years. And for 13 and a half years, he knew who he was. He was a painter. He loved his dungarees. And not only that, he moved into a different zone, a different spiritual zone with his artwork. And it became really just a completely different sort of genre. And I don't think you can dismiss that as, unimportant. I think it was maybe him finding himself.
Yeah.
Finding his truer self.
But you also find that anxiety is like a symptom. You know, people who are suffering from vascular dementia, and I know a few, have become very anxious people. And, you know, I often wonder, is it because there's a part of them that knows there's something they can't do, and therefore that's what they're getting anxious about? Or is it something else?
So in the book, I make the claim that if you can use the word kindness, now I recognize, you know, it may be too generous, but if there is a kind point in the progression of dementia, it is when people forget that they forget. Because then they're no longer insightful into this problem. And they can oftentimes, sometimes with help, you know, have a benign emotional adjustment more into the pure present. So you read all these books, you know, about the now. And
yes, exactly.
Escaping chronological pressures. You know, we're always rushing from point A to point B.
Yeah.
Now that's gone. And I find spiritually, personally, you know, when I'm with deeply forgetful people, I actually enjoy it because it's like going to a meditational retreat. If I'm going to be with them in a meaningful way, and if I'm going to notice and pick up on their expressions, I've got to put time on the shelf as much as I can.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. It's something that we all need to do. We don't have a lot of time left, probably less than 10 minutes, but I would like to offer some tools or some strategies or some insights to people who are caregivers. You talked before we came on air about communication, and there are ways to communicate with someone that we wouldn't think about unless somebody told us that can actually be really helpful. Can you give us some little tips?
Well, there's a lot in the book, in the second half of the book, about how to communicate. You know, we have child life specialists all over the world now who get degrees in communicating with children around difficulties, and they do a wonderful service in the children's hospitals, for example. We need the same thing with the deeply forgetful. There was a wonderful guy at the University of Bristol who wrote a book called Personhood and Dementia. And he was excellent on this. But the major thing with communication, first of all, avoid open-ended questions. So don't approach someone who's deeply forgetful and say, would you like post-toasties or would you like ham and eggs? Oh, no, I'm sorry. I got that wrong. Don't ask them, what would you like for breakfast?
Yeah.
Because that
yeah.
puts them on the spot. They become anxious. Yeah. But if you're cueing them with your language, what would you like, this or that? Then, of course, you'll be surprised that they'll respond much more frequently. You know, I talk in the book about a fellow named Jim at a nursing home in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. And he was really quite profoundly, deeply forgetful. He was in a special care unit. Dr. Foley and I went into his room. We read the little bio sketch about him. He had two sons. He'd been an accountant. And so I asked the nurse to show us over to Jim. And we went over to Jim, and I took him by the arm and sat him down at a table. And I made my first mistake. I asked him, the bio sketches said he had two sons and so forth. I said, how are your sons? And he was frozen. He was frozen. But then I let a little time pass, and I asked him, so Jim, how's Zach? And he lit up. I mean, if emotion was fire, it was amazing, you know. And then I asked him, how's Lou? And he just lit up again, and he was joyful and effervescent. And he connected with me on that. And then he actually uttered a few words. They weren't extensive, but a few words. So he reacted because I was reminding him with my language of the people he loved. And so, you know, there's a passage I love in St. Paul, nothing can separate us from the love of God. Well, the supreme being, whatever you want to call it, but deep forgetfulness, if you learn communication techniques, you can actually allow those connections to manifest. And then this guy, Jim, he had a thick twig about a half a foot long, which he kept in his hand, and it was blunted, it was rounded, so he wasn't dangerous in any way. And he took that and he put it in my palms. And then he smiled this smile, and if a smile of joy could be electric, the place would have caught on fire. And I couldn't figure it out, but I quietly gave it back to him. And then I asked the nurse, so Jim, what's the story with this twig? So I asked her, what's the story with Jim's twig? And she said he grew up on a farm in Ohio and he loved his father very much. So like a lot of these people, he'd gone back to the time early in life when he experienced tender, loving care. And it turns out that she said his father gave him a chore every morning, which was to bring kindling in for the fireplace. So that was a symbol of the bond between him and his very loving father. And then astonishingly, there was an old beat up hand doll, like you'd give your daughter when she's, you know, a year old, you know, it, with all the little brown fur and everything. But it was so old that it was just, you know, basically the linen. And he bent down, he was ambulating. Surprisingly, he bent down, he picked it up. And he went over to the corner of this special care unit. And there was a woman seated in a comfortable chair, and she was whimpering and crying. And he put it on her lap and he touched her on the shoulder and she stopped crying. So I asked the nurse, what's the story with that doll? And the nurse said, well, that was her doll. So that was her symbol, just like the twig was Jim's symbol. That was her symbol. So when you get into these lives, they may not have linear rationality, which is the problem with like Kant and John Locke, excuse me, Christ Church, Oxford, you know, but their symbolic rationality is there. And if you can live in that domain, there can be a lot of emotional intelligence. I mean, Jim had as much emotional intelligence as lots of people I know walking down the streets of Manhattan right now. So you have to use your imagination, and you have to communicate, and you have to value actions that may seem that they have no purpose, but they do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the more we talk about it, I really don't think enough research has been done in the right areas here. I mean, you know, the big question everyone's asking is, can Alzheimer's be prevented? The question that comes to my mind is, should Alzheimer's be prevented? I mean, we don't know.
We don't know. And the interesting thing, you know, of course, now people are saying in the last 3 years that healthy aging is a good way to try to prevent dementia of various types. And that's for sure, you know, walk a half an hour a day for vascular health. Be careful, you know, Mediterranean diet may be a little better than most, although there's no knockdown drag out signs around these things. But you know, healthy aging can contribute to healthy brain. So there's no doubt about it. But really, you know, what can we learn from the deeply forgetful? That's what my book is about. And, you know, I learn what's really important in life from them. I learn that noticing, listening, love is really important in life. Loyalty, care. And you can have a positive psychology. In some ways, Mike, is a positive psychology of dementia, because I'm willing to talk about humor, joy, laughter. I mean, I knew a fellow in Cleveland who was quite severely forgetful, and he had told me all kinds of jokes earlier on in my career. We'd be walking down the streets and now he couldn't remember these jokes. And I couldn't even communicate with him because he wasn't capable of it at the time. But just even the day before he died, I was at his home. And I said, do you remember this joke you told me? What's the Irish definition of hospitality? He was an Irish immigrant into Boston and a great neurologist. He couldn't respond. And I said, well, you'd say it was making people feel perfectly at home when you'd be a wishing they were. and then when he heard that, he cracked up. I mean, if humor could change his whole being in a millisecond, that's what did it. And then I asked him a few other ones about the Irish and the English, because he was into that sort of stuff, and I'm not going to repeat them here, but they were very appropriate. And so I found that by using his jokes that he had loved over the course of a lifetime and sort of bring them into now his reality while he's deeply forgetful, he could connect to humor. And that's something you want to learn, because during the last 4 or 5 years with all this COVID and all this chaos, you know, we've sometimes forgotten how to smile. Somehow we've forgotten how to laugh. Yeah. And I think that's so tragic. But I can do that with people who are deeply forgetful. If I know a little bit about their history.
Yeah. We're out of time now, I'm afraid, Stephen. If there's one thing, a very brief thing, that you could leave our viewers with that's really important about this book, what would it be?
Well, the most important thing is that forgetfulness is a continuum. Sometimes I'm out in the parking lot and I forget where my car is, and I ask a student, where's my car? And they laugh. It's not so good if I forget if I drove to work. There's a difference there. But we all are frail. We all are vulnerable. We all are dependent and interdependent. And we pretend. It's not ultimate reality, but we pretend that we are independent and that we are invulnerable. And one thing you really learn around this population is that that is not the ultimate reality. The ultimate reality is that we are frail, vulnerable, and dependent. And we need to acknowledge that and build a world around it and structure our healthcare systems around it, because otherwise we're just not playing with the real world.
Well, on that note, Stephen G. Post, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Sandy. It's so nice to see you.
You too. Dignity for deeply forgetful people, how caregivers can meet the challenges of Alzheimer's disease, by Stephen G. Post, is published by John Hopkins University Press. For more information about Stephen's work and books, visit stephengpost.com. And that's Stephen with a PH.
With a PH.
A PhD. That brings us to the end of this week's show. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'll be back at the same time next week with another edition of What Is Going On. Till then, it's goodbye from me.
Thank you.